Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. There's a town in the Dominican Republic called Villa Altagracia. It's about 50 miles from the country's capital, Santo Domingo. In 2010, a new apparel factory in town issued its first paychecks to a couple dozen workers. Naming itself after the town, the new Altagracia factory paid employees the equivalent of $125. It was a transformative moment for workers to receive a living wage. In Spanish, it's called salario digno, meaning wage with dignity. One worker said, "To me, that means being taken into account. You're actually valued at work. People are able to get a higher education, better intellectual development, and better nutrition. Without this, we can't have goals." Another worker said, "I don't lose sleep anymore as a mother, wondering how I will make ends meet. I would say Altagracia is the salvation for a lot of mothers." Today, Altagracia employs about 200 people making t-shirts and sweatshirts. In July, Altagracia announced a partnership with the NFL's Dallas Cowboys to develop a new line of t-shirts. The factory not only aims to make a profit, but is set on upending the centuries-long industry standard of squeezing the sweat from poorly paid workers who are also treated very poorly. The book Sewing Hope tells the story of how Altagracia challenges the conventional wisdom that factories cannot afford to do the right thing. Joining us today to talk about Altagracia and the anti-sweatshop factory model are two guests. Sarah Adler Milstein is a worker rights advocate. Sarah has served as field director for Latin America and the Caribbean for the Worker Rights Consortium. She's co-author of the new book, Sewing Hope, How One Factory Challenges the Apparel Industry Sweatshops. And she joins us in studio. Hi, Sarah. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Scott Nova is co-author of the book Sewing Hope and executive director of the Worker Rights Consortium, a research and advocacy organization dedicated to combating sweatshops and advancing the rights of workers in the global supply chain. And Scott joins us on the line from New York. Hi, Scott. Thank you joining us.
Hi, good to be with you.
Great to have you. Well, thank you so much to both of you for writing this book, because we've done a lot of shows about sweatshops, and this is such an important topic. Sarah, I understand that you were doing research in the Dominican Republic town Villa Altagracia before the factory existed. What were you doing there? What was your research?
Well, I originally hoped to document a success story of student activists in the U.S. and workers in the factory working together to improve conditions. But before I could even arrive to conduct my research, the factory where conditions had improved and activists and workers had worked together to get a collective bargaining agreement with improved working conditions, the factory closed. And I think this is really common in the race to the bottom, is the factories that make improvements are punished. And so that is part of the reason why we see such problematic conditions in the apparel industry with sub-poverty wages and unsafe working conditions, is those factories that make improvements are punished.
And the workers who stand up for their rights and put everything on the line, in fact, you write about many of these workers, they and others are told that if you continue to do this, you will lose your job because the factory will close.
Absolutely. And I think many workers are risking their physical safety when they speak out on conditions. And we've documented in multiple cases threats and often violence against the workers who speak out about the terrible conditions. So often the human cost of business as usual is that workers are risking their lives, sometimes even just for showing up at work in factories that are unsafe due to factory fires or factory collapses.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the conditions and the workers, because again, Altagracia is the only factory in the Global South that pays a living wage. So when did you learn about the Altagracia factory, Sarah?
Well, I was very lucky that I was able to help start up the Altagracia factory. So I started working for the Workers' Rights Consortium just when the idea of establishing an anti-sweatshop model became a reality. So one of my very first projects at the Workers' Rights Consortium was conducting the living wage study that became the living wage for Altagracia. And I was very lucky to work with the workers on the ground in the community and the local community organizations and unions to develop the Altagracia factory, and then see its transformational effects from the fairest hiring process we've ever seen in the apparel industry that was transparent, where workers didn't face any discrimination, to the first living wage paycheck, to seeing workers slowly be able to realize their goals with a living wage.
And Scott, your connection is a little different than Sarah's to Alta Gracia. When did you first learn about it?
Well, the Worker Rights Consortium had been working for many years in efforts to improve conditions in the garment industry. And one of the issues we'd focused on, of course, is the sub-poverty wages that are ubiquitous in global apparel production. Wages as low as 30 cents an hour in countries like Bangladesh and well under a dollar at the time Alta Gracia was created in the Dominican Republic. And we approached the idea of helping to create a living wage factory in part to demonstrate that clothing doesn't have to be made at poverty wages, that it can be made profitably at a living wage. And so we were involved from the outset in conceiving and developing the idea and then helping the factory get up and running.
What's amazing to me is that, as you said, Scott, some people who work in factories, mostly women, are making 30 cents an hour, and they are working in factories that make clothing for some of the top brands in the world. There's a lot to talk about here, but what struck me the most is that Alta Gracia's living wage is about $2 an hour, right? So that's the living wage in the Dominican Republic?
Close to three, actually.
Close to three.
An hour, yeah.
Okay, so close to $3 an hour. And this adds less than a dollar to the cost of producing a typical sweatshirt. Because you often hear, and as you both point out, even from liberal columnists, for example, that if you did pay workers a living wage, they would most likely lose their jobs. And they're just lucky to have a job. I mean, you hear that all the time. But Sarah, can you talk about this? Paying a living wage at this factory in the Dominican Republic adds less than $1 to the cost of producing a typical sweatshirt.
Absolutely. I think people don't realize how little of the cost at the store level goes to the workers who produce it. So for a $35 sweatshirt that you might see in a store, in a typical factory, less than 50 cents of that is going to a worker. And for lower cost goods like T-shirts, that's going to be even less. So the 90 cents additional living wage premium that's paid for Alta Gracia is very low at the cost of the good, but it's transformational and triples wages at the level of the factory. And that can have such transformational effects. And I'd like to tell a story because I think it contextualizes what this means. Matilde, who is one of the Alta Gracia workers, before working at Alta Gracia, was working at a typical factory producing undergarments for the U.S. She was working 11 to 12 hour days and with a 2 hour commute each way. And even with these immensely long hours, she was not able to put three square meals on the table for her family. She was not able to even survive economically. She had to borrow from family. And more importantly, she couldn't access health care. And this was really important for Matilde because she had chronic pain and fatigue, and she knew something was really wrong. She did not have the discretionary income to see a doctor. And later, when she started at Alta Gracia, she was able to finally see a doctor, obviously with quite a bit of trepidation. And she had reason to be concerned because she had cancer. Mm. But for the first time in her life, she had the discretionary income to undergo the surgery and the treatment, and she successfully fought off cancer. And so she returned to Alta Gracia really excited to help other people get the kind of treatment that she had. So she went back to school to be a medical technician and was able to pay that tuition with a living wage on top of being able to provide for her family. And so now she's a full-time medical technician. So Sometimes the biggest success stories are not even workers who are still at Alta Gracia because they've been able to pursue their long-term dreams.
Can you talk a little bit more about this, Scott? We'll get into other stories of workers, but it's just so important to really focus on the fact that you can pay people a living wage and it would only add $1 to the cost of a sweatshirt, for example.
No, it's exactly right. And that is the silver lining of our screwed up global garment industry, which is that the problem is actually solvable for a modest increase in production costs. The problem, of course, is getting the big brands and retailers to be willing to pay that modest additional amount so the workers who make the clothes can have a decent life instead of struggling in poverty, as Sarah just described in the example that she cited. You made the point about people arguing that workers should be happy with whatever they get. That argument is indeed made very often. But just because a brand can get away with paying workers a sub-poverty wage of, say, 30 cents an hour or 50 cents an hour, just because they can get away with it doesn't mean they should do it. Mm. And what we need to do is convince the brands and retailers that they have an obligation to treat the people who make their clothes decently, that that end is achievable with a very small increase in the price they pay for the products. So we can make that happen, and instead of having one factory in the DR as a shining positive example of living wage, we can have it across the sector.
So why do you think these massive multinationals like Nike, for example, I'm looking up the CEO pay, but it's a huge, I mean, the hourly wage is just is massive. Why don't these companies increase worker pay when we're talking about an extra dollar to a piece of clothing?
Well, first of all, they don't do it because they have no legal obligation to do it. That's part of the problem. The minimum wage that is set in countries like the Dominican Republic and Bangladesh and Vietnam is set by national governments based on what they believe the brands and retailers are willing to pay. As a result, minimum wages are set far below what a family actually needs in order to live decently. So the brands and retailers create an international labor market in which governments feel pressured to keep minimum wages as low as possible. So the contract factories producing the goods for the brands can comply with the law even when they're paying people an extraordinarily low wage. And of course, there are no rules whatsoever here in the United States for the way companies like Nike and Walmart and Target and Gap behave overseas. So because there are no legal obligations, it's necessary for consumers, for advocates, to find other means to convince companies to behave responsibly.
And I just found it. Nike CEO Mark Parker makes about $25,000 an hour. And workers in Indonesia who work 55 hours, 6 days a week, make about $184 a month. You both have been doing this work for a while now. Why do you think it takes so long? I mean, so much pressure, for example, has been put specifically on Nike and The Gap to do the right thing. And when you look at what's going on with Alta Gracia, it's not that difficult to do the right thing. So, Sarah, why is it that these two, for example, people are still putting so much pressure on them and we're not seeing much change?
I think the way the industry has been set up to create many layers of subcontracting between the ultimate brand and the factory, and this has been really exploited by the brands to sort of wash their hands of the conditions in the factories and say, oh, we don't run the factories, when we know that if there's a quality concern, that those exact same brands have complete control over the production process. So it's really a lack of will, not a lack of ability to control the conditions in factories. But I think the industry has been set up on purpose to insulate those factories, insulate the brands from the factories that are producing from them.
Well, and it's important to bear in mind that it goes beyond just the garment industry. I mean, in California, you have some very prominent technology companies. Let's take Apple as an example. Apple is paying sub-poverty wages throughout its global supply chain, just as Walmart is paying sub-poverty wages throughout its global supply chain. It affects apparel, it affects electronics, it affects toy manufacturing. All across these different industries, we see the same essential model of powerful brands and retailers selling products at high prices in the United States, taking advantage of lax regulation, low minimum wages, and the desperation of working people in countries like the Dominican Republic to get away with paying people a wage that no human being would consider fair. And that's the problem that we have to fix.
Today we are speaking about sweatshops and the anti-sweatshop Alta Gracia in the Dominican Republic, the only factory in the global south that pays a living wage. And we're speaking today with Sarah Adler Milstein. She's a worker rights advocate and co-author of Sewing Hope, How One Factory Challenges the Apparel Industry Sweatshops. And I should say that John Klein is the co-author of Sewing Hope. I misspoke there earlier. Sorry about that. And Scott Nova is executive director of the Worker Rights Consortium, a research and advocacy organization dedicated to combating sweatshops and advancing the rise of workers in the global supply chain. And as we heard, the living wage in the Dominican Republic is almost $3 an hour. And that is what workers are making at Alta Gracia. That adds only $1 to the cost of an average sweatshirt. So the question is, why aren't other companies stepping up and doing the right thing to treat workers fairly? Sarah, since you were involved with Alta Gracia from the ground up, talk a little bit about how this happened. Because what's also so unique about Alta Gracia is instead of completely shunning the labor activists in the Dominican Republic, Alta Gracia invited them in to come up with a business model.
That's actually one of the trademarks of Alta Gracia, is bringing historically antagonistic parties together and working together. So apparel executives in the United States, factory managers in the Dominican Republic, and labor rights activists, who usually are only negotiating on opposite sides of the table, were sitting down together and trying to figure out what was workable and how to create an anti-sweatshop. And I think this started from the hiring up. So hiring in free trade zones is very problematic in terms of there's sexual exploitation, there's kickbacks, and just workers are mistreated throughout that whole process.
Can you tell us, what is a free trade zone?
Oh, thank you. Free trade zones are the zone, the industrial areas where factories are located, and often they have lower minimum wages to make them more competitive in the cutthroat race to the bottom. So they're geographic areas where factories are located that export primarily to the U.S. and abroad.
And who came up with this concept, free trade zone? Who makes the rules for these zones?
Well, this is a concept that was developed by national governments trying to pursue an export-driven economic growth strategy based on the idea that if you make things as easy, as cheap, and as poorly regulated as possible, you will attract Western brands and retailers to come produce in your country. And unfortunately, that approach has worked in ways that have been very lucrative for big brands and retailers, but very destructive for the people who actually make the products.
So continue your story about how Alta Gracia was formed.
So going back to the hiring process, usually union leaders are blacklisted, that there's a circulated list of who are the troublemakers to avoid in the industry. In Alta Gracia, those people were invited in to help develop the labor standards for the factory and were involved in setting the labor standards before the doors even opened. So I remember one of the workers pulled me aside during the hiring, because we were observing to make sure everything was being done correctly. And they said, "You realize that there's union leaders here, right?" Assuming that there's no way a factory would ever hire a union leader. And in fact, these were the very same leaders who had helped us develop the labor standards for the factory. And so on the first day, when there was a union leaders present and hired, also visibly pregnant workers hired, who usually are systematically discriminated against, even though it's totally illegal in most apparel producing countries, that sent a message that it was a different kind of factory. And we spent months with the labor groups and the unions in country trying to figure out what kind of orientation would be helpful to workers to try and understand what a different type of factory this was. And we actually spent much of our time worrying about the managers, that the managers wouldn't get it, that the managers would go back to their old practices. And it was really refreshing after we did our presentation on freedom of association, the right to join a union. We expected the supervisors to be pretty hostile because of their experiences in the past. And one of the supervisors came up to me and he said, "I'm so excited. I've always wanted to work in a factory like this." He said, "But I have just one question. Why can't supervisors join the union?" So that just floored us. That's not what we expected. And I think one of the really pleasant surprises is when you switch the incentives and you switch the business model, everyone starts acting differently. So factory managers, who often have to do the industry's dirty work, became super involved community members who cared about workers beyond just the factory floor and took very courageous stands in the community, challenging some of the exploitative loan sharks who are going after workers' relatives. So I can't even express how transformational it is. It's not just about the dollars and cents that go to workers. It's about changing the incentives and how everyone ends up acting differently as a result.
So Scott, can you talk also about that? That's such a really important point.
Well, the incentives are the key point. In the global apparel industry and in other manufacturing sectors, all the incentives run against respecting the rights of workers from the perspective of the factory managers. It's important to bear in mind, these are contract factories. The brands don't own them. The contract factories have to constantly compete with each other to get the brand's business, and the brands use the leverage they have to drive down prices to the point where most factories are being paid prices for their garments so low that it's simply impossible at those prices for the factory to comply with the law, much less pay workers a living wage. And while the brands and retailers pay a lot of lip service to labor rights and human rights, their actual sourcing practices, the way they procure the clothing that they sell to the public, virtually guarantees abusive conditions and poverty wages. What happened at Alta Gracia was a complete reversal of those incentives. The managers at Alta Gracia understand that their factory is not going to succeed by offering the lowest price. Rather, it's going to succeed by demonstrating that it is fully respecting the rights of workers, paying a living wage, as well as producing a good product. And with those incentives, you get managers behaving in a very different way.
Can you tell us more about how this supply chain works? Because you also have stories about how workers, in fact, one of the workers, Yenny, and we'll talk about her later, she was working at a hat factory. It was a company that made hats like, you know, that college students use and sports players use, BJ&B. It was a factory in the Dominican Republic. And she was given a raise and a promotion, but she didn't want to be one of these supervisors that had to crack down on workers and treat them horribly. And if you don't do that, you lose your job. So, Scott, can you just give us a sense of the power structure in these factories and how that works?
Well, it's hard to imagine a more extreme power imbalance than one we see in the global garment industry between factory managers operating at the behest of the most powerful corporations in the world and workers being paid pennies an hour with no financial resources, no political power, no capacity to fight back as individuals against mistreatment by managers. But the way, of course, in which workers do seek to fight back is by acting collectively, by organizing, by trying to form unions. And Yenny, who you mentioned, who is an extraordinary person, one of the most courageous people I've met in many years of doing this work, played a crucial role at the cap factory you mentioned in organizing a union that did achieve significant improvements in working conditions. And we see this all over the world. We see workers under extraordinarily challenging circumstances taking huge personal risks to join together with fellow workers to try to improve conditions. Unfortunately, they are often initially face severe retaliation as a result of that. Yenny, for example, was fired in the early stages of her union organizing efforts, but although she was ultimately reinstated after the factory came under international pressure. But it is this effort by workers to organize that provides some of the reason for hope that there can be positive change in the industry.
That is Scott Nova. He's executive director of the Worker Rights Consortium, a research and advocacy group dedicated to combating sweatshops and advancing the rights of workers in global supply chains. We're also joined today by Sarah Adler Milstein, a worker rights advocate. Sarah has served as field director for Latin America and the Caribbean for the Worker Rights Consortium, and she is co-author with John Klein of Sewing Hope, How One Factory Challenges the Apparel Industry Sweatshops. And it is a very important and inspiring story. It's about Alta Gracia. This is an apparel factory in the Dominican Republic where workers are actually paid a living wage, about $3 an hour. And in order to pay workers a living wage, it costs an extra dollar to add to a sweatshirt, for example. So that's really a key point. This is such an important issue, and if we do a lot of shows about sweatshops, why is it that Alta Gracia is the only apparel factory in the global south that actually pays a living wage? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about an anti-sweatshop in the Dominican Republic. It's called Alta Gracia. It's the only apparel factory in the global south that pays workers a living wage. And this factory makes clothing mostly for colleges across the country. In July, they announced a partnership with the NFL's Dallas Cowboys to develop a new line of t-shirts. And today we are talking with Sarah Adler Milstein, a workers' rights advocate, co-author with John Klein of Sewing Hope, How One Factory Challenges the Apparel Industry Sweatshops. We're also joined by Scott Nova, executive director of the Worker Rights Consortium, and you can find details at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Yes, congratulations and great thanks to the Alta Gracia factory. I hope it may be a pioneer across the global south. And I also want to thank your guests for the expose of all these scandals in these industries. Unfortunately, in the United States, things are going exactly the opposite way in a really big way. There's a decision in coming to the Supreme Court by March called the Janus versus AFSCME decision. It's set to make public employee unions across the United States open shop, or also called right-to-work places, where employees don't have to pay their dues. And the objective, you know, it's a Koch brothers cooked-up case, and the objective is to financially wipe out this last highly unionized sector in the United States. And with Neil Gorsuch, the 5-4 anti-labor majority is restored, so the decision is sure to go through. And it is a juggernaut. I mean, public employee unions are the last bastion of unionization, good unionization, in the United States, and they're set to wipe us out. The only way to resist this after March is, and this is a call out to public employees, pay your dues.
Well, Judy, thank you. Well, I'll put that on our show idea list, and we can talk more about that. But Scott, this is related to what's happening overseas, because this is just a global race to the bottom. When Obama supported the Trans-Pacific Partnership, there were a lot of stories about how people who have, or multinationals that have factories in China, were really, they couldn't wait to move them to Vietnam where they could pay lower wages. Can you talk about that, the global race to the bottom? And at a time when we have someone like Donald Trump in office, how do we tackle this issue?
Well, this is the manner in which brands and retailers use the enormous leverage they have, not just over contract factories, but over whole countries to drive down wages and working conditions. And you're right, China, amazingly enough, is now considered a high-wage country from the standpoint of apparel companies. Wages are considered too high at between $1 and $1.50 an hour for Chinese garment workers, depending on which region of the country you're talking about. So there's a desire to move more production to Vietnam and other countries with substantially lower wages. So you get factories competing with each other to cut production costs to a minimum. You get countries competing with each other to offer the lowest wages, the least regulation. And the consequence, of course, entirely predictably, is sub-poverty wages and brutal working conditions.
Mm-hmm. And we should say that the reason why wages are higher now, a little higher in China, is because so many workers there took to the streets to say they were tired of being exploited.
Now, it's a very important point. Although independent unions are illegal in China, workers there organize anyway and have carried out large strikes, mass demonstrations, often with serious consequences for the leaders, who are often jailed under Chinese law. And that has been a big factor in raising wages in that country. And, of course, it's frustrating to see brands and retailers responding to improvements in wages and conditions by looking to other countries with worse conditions and lower wages as an alternative.
Scott, I know we have to let you go in 10 minutes, so I want to make sure we get this question out before you have to leave us. What is the best way to tackle this issue? We've done so many shows about this, and we've heard tips like, when you go into a store, ask how workers are treated. Go on social media and, you know, tag Nike and say, why do you pay workers less than a dollar an hour when your CEO makes almost $25,000 an hour? What do you think is most effective?
Well, I think the key is to understand that it is collective action that creates change. You know, the other heroes in this Alta Gracia story are the student activists. Mm-hmm. At colleges and universities across the United States, who for many years have been generating pressure on the universities to insist on better working conditions in the factories where brands like Nike and Adidas make university logo clothing. And it is that student activism, that collective action by students across the nation, that created a market for the products Alta Gracia sells. What Alta Gracia primarily makes is sweatshirts and t-shirts with university names and logos. They're mostly sold at the university bookstores. It was activism by students that made Alta Gracia possible, because it created a market for the product. And people who want to see change happen in terms of labor rights and human rights globally need to join an organization that's fighting for change, a grassroots group, a labor union, some place where people are coming together to use their collective power to fight for better conditions and better treatment for workers.
Sarah, as you and John write in the book Sewing Hope, the shockingly bad conditions at BJ&B, this is the hat company in the Dominican Republic, were the catalyst that helped build the USAS, United Students Against Sweatshops, organization nationally. College students found out how people were treated.
Absolutely. And Alta Gracia was really based on these initial connections. The as you mentioned, Yenny and her coworkers were speaking out against the terrible conditions at the BJ&B factory, and they would have been fired and blacklisted with no recourse had they not connected with student activists in the U.S. and held those the brands that were producing there accountable in their home turf. And so that's how they were able to get their jobs back. And so these connections between workers at the factory level and consumers in the U.S., this really powerful connection, allowed there to be the connections that made Alta Gracia possible.
Scott, given what is possible at Alta Gracia and the publicity that this is now getting, are other companies looking at this? Do you expect other companies will make changes?
I would like to think that global brands and retailers would leap at the chance to behave responsibly and lift wages for millions of people and still make a profit. But I think it would be naive to imagine that big companies will do this of their own volition. As has been the case throughout history, corporations improve their behavior when they're pushed to do so. I do believe there is enormous potential for effective advocacy and activism around these issues. And brands and retailers, it's important to understand, are afraid of consumer concerns about human rights in the supply chain. Their biggest asset for these companies is their brand image and reputation. And they understand that if their brand image and reputation is associated with sweatshop conditions, that asset is devalued. And so because that fear exists, that recognition of consumer power, it is possible for activists to generate real pressure on these brands and retailers and bring about change. And I do see, particularly on the issue of living wage, I do see great potential for activism to compel some of these companies to begin to improve wages.
Well, speaking of activism, Scott, if college students, and they've done incredible work on this issue, if they were able to organize and convince colleges to end contracts with sweatshops and to create contracts with Alta Gracia, for example, what about the power of sports stars who wear these clothes? Because if Alta Gracia announced a partnership with the NFL's Dallas Cowboys, I was just thinking about a lot of the players who are taking a knee, who are becoming very politically active. I mean, what if we had Scott Curry stand up and say, you know what, Nike, I'm wearing your shirt, but you're treating your workers horribly. Have you all been in contact with some of these sports stars?
It's a great question, and there have been sporadic contacts over the years. You know, there are a lot of demands and requests for the time and attention of famous figures in the sports world. And for the most part, with limited exceptions, this is not an area where we've seen key athletes turning their focus. And you're right, if that happened, it would make a big difference. These athletes are brands in their own right and very valuable brands. And if they did stand up and insist that they don't want to have a shirt on their back that's made in a sweatshop, that would create very powerful leverage for the sports apparel companies to improve their operations.
And I meant to say Steph Curry, but my brother's laughing right now, who's a big sports fan. Scott, we've got one more call for you, and then we'll let you go. Let's hear from Philip. Hi, Philip. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I was just calling. I wanted to first make a point about the export trade zones. These were initially set up. The concept was that you had developing countries which had extremely high tariffs, and they would set up a zone where you could bring inputs in, both materials and equipment, duty-free. The labor would be provided locally, and then the goods that were exported also went out duty-free. This provided employment to people where there was no employment before. So although I do absolutely stand with your drive to improve the wages of these people in these developing countries, there was a slight misperception that you might have promoted by characterizing these as zones where the goal was to exploit the laborers.
Right. Well, I mean, the trade zones exist to attract foreign capital to produce in the country. In many cases, you have trade zones where the labor law is actually weaker in the zone by design, to make the zone an attractive place to produce. Bangladesh, for example, which is the world's second largest apparel producer, has a whole separate set of labor laws for the zones, the trade zones, and they're substantially weaker. And one key difference is unions are illegal in the trade zones. Now, the government of Bangladesh, which does allow unions outside the trade zones, did that for one reason and one reason only, because they know that major brands and retailers like the idea of producing in factories where there are no unions, because that means It's easier to push people around and easier to produce at very low cost. So there is a partnership between the elites in a country like Bangladesh and the leaders of big corporations in the U.S. and Europe in which they get together to create an economic context in which workers end up being exploited quite grievously, and that's what needs to change.
Well, Scott, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
You too. Scott Nova is Executive Director of the Worker Rights Consortium, a research and advocacy organization dedicated to combating sweatshops and advancing the rights of workers in global supply chains. And staying with us for the rest of the hour is Sarah Adler-Milstein, a worker rights advocate. She and John Klein wrote the book, Sewing Hope, How One Factory Challenges the Apparel Industry's Sweatshops. Find information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments about sweatshops and this anti-sweatshop model that's embraced by Alta Gracia, this is a company, an apparel factory in the Dominican Republic that is the only one in the global south that actually pays a living wage. And they make shirts and sweatshirts for colleges. They are available in college bookstores. They just announced a partnership with the NFL's Dallas Cowboys to develop a new line of T-shirts. Sarah, do you think that Alta Gracia will be working with other major sports teams on this? Because that would be huge if others signed on.
That's our hope. And our book includes a call out to brands that if they're serious about their stated corporate social responsibility goals of improving conditions, that they should source from Alta Gracia. And I think that's one of the initial ways to expand the Alta Gracia model is just to have more brands like the Dallas Cowboys source from Alta Gracia. And then hopefully that will create the change that factories see that if they do change their model and pay a living wage and respect workers' rights, that there is actually demand on the brand side for it. So that's our hope, that sports teams and brands do the right thing and at least as an initial step source from Alta Gracia and then transfer their supply chain to living wage goods.
And what about sports stars who sign these lucrative deals with companies like Nike and Adidas?
Yeah, it would be amazing if they looked into it and spoke out about the conditions. What's kind of interesting about the Alta Gracia model is that their celebrity spokespeople are the workers. And so that flips the model on its head, and instead of having goods produced, trying to make workers as invisible as possible to consumers and the conditions, Alta Gracia does the opposite. They have speaking tours where the frontline workers who are sewing the goods are going out to university campuses, talking to workers. Students are coming to workers' homes, seeing where they used to live when they were working at conventional sweatshops and seeing where they're living now with running water, with safer conditions that can withstand hurricanes, which is a very serious concern for the Caribbean. So I think flipping this and not just looking to outside celebrities, but looking to your workers as celebrity spokespeople is sort of an interesting positive side effect of the model.
And in Sarah and John's book, Sewing Hope, there are a number of photos of mostly women who work in the factories, sometimes with their children, and really incredible stories about how this model has changed their lives. We're getting a lot of emails, Sarah, from listeners who want to know where they can buy these clothes.
So Alta Gracia is primarily sold at university bookstores. So at your local university will have them. They also sell blanks. So if you want to, for an event, be able to print on union living wage goods, you can. There's a way to buy those directly, either printed on blanks or just blank T-shirts and sweatshirts. So if you go to Alta Gracia's website, you can also buy blanks if you're not interested in university logoed apparel.
I noticed on the website you cannot shop online. Is that something you might do in the future?
That's our hope, is that there's enough demand that they're able to expand. And I think our hope is also that they would expand beyond the university market.
What about, you know, people who say the supply chain obviously is so global, but there's this massive buy local movement that what people should do is try to find an anti-sweatshop in the U.S. if they're going to buy clothing to try to cut back on shipping costs. And at this point, it's so difficult because you have the cotton grown in one place, sewn somewhere else, and then sent to a different place. I mean, it's just the supply chain for one shirt can be affected and touched in three or four different countries, right?
Our hope is that the Alta Gracia model gets replicated both abroad and in the U.S. Many people know that there's serious issues of wage theft in the U.S. apparel industry in Los Angeles. Workers are getting paid under the federal and the California minimum wage and sometimes as low as $4 an hour. Uh-huh. So this is not an issue that's just a global issue. It's happening right here in our backyard. So I think the Alta Gracia model needs to be expanded not just abroad, but domestically as well.
And that goes to Steve's question, who says, how can we find information on specific companies' labor practices? He says that he's loyal to one company in particular, but he sees more information on their website about environmental practices, but labor not so much.
So the Workers' Rights Consortium has a public database of their investigation, so that's a good place to start. They have excellent information. Also, the International Labor Rights Forum has good information online. There isn't a lot of supply chain transparency. And while it's the university market has been held to account to disclose where their factories are, that hasn't happened more generally. Some brands have chosen to do that more widely. But unfortunately, one of the issues is just simply supply chain transparency and just trying to figure out where these brands are producing. And if that could be expanded beyond the college market, that amount of transparency in and of itself could be a catalyst for change.
We have a related email from Donald who says, is there a list of retailers who support living wages for garment workers? A website with relevant information would be very helpful.
So I always caution people that this is not a problem we can buy our way out of. There simply isn't enough sweat-free alternatives. There's certainly Alta Gracia is one, and there's other small brands and retailers that are trying to do the right thing. But I think the real possibility for change is holding these large brands and retailers who can absolutely afford to pay a living wage to account. So I often tell people it's not easy. Collective action is the way to change. And many people would love to be able to make a different consumer choice and be able to transform the industry, but there's just not enough alternatives out there. So we really need to be on the hook as consumers to transform the industry as it is now.
So what can we learn from the college students who have been very loud about this issue? These people obviously want to take action.
Absolutely. The first rule is everything that the apparel industry says is not possible to question it. So in the beginning of the fight that the students had on campuses, they were told there's absolutely no way we can provide you our list of factories. These are trade secrets. We'll go out of business. And now that's standard. So I think the same arguments are being made by the brands and retailers. Oh, we don't control the factories. Oh, right. we have no control over the conditions. And that's just simply not true. So question what the brands are telling you and retailers are telling you is possible. And as Scott mentioned, collective action is what makes a difference. So International Labor Rights Forum, the Clean Clothes Campaign, are organizing consumers more broadly. I think there's great potential to also leverage public procurement, so federal contracts, city and state contracts. The city of San Francisco, in fact, has a sweat-free ordinance and transparency. If more cities and states had that, that would also transform the industry. So looking at larger contracts and leveraging those is obviously an excellent way to make change, and that's made change in the university industry. But there certainly is things individual consumers can do by joining organizations like the International Labor Rights Forum and the Clean Clothes Campaign.
And can you repeat some of those websites? We're going to put them on ours.
Mm-hmm. So one is the International Labor Rights Forum, mm-hmm. and the other is the Clean Clothes Campaign. And if you're a university student, absolutely check out United Students Against Sweatshops. They're doing incredible work to hold some of the major brands accountable for conditions in the apparel industry.
And I also just want to give a shout out to the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights. They recently shut down their organization. Charles Kernighan and Barbara Briggs spent years doing amazing work on this issue. When there was the fire in Bangladesh, which killed how many people? Do you remember?
So the Rana Plaza collapse killed over 1,000 people. And in 2013, more than 800 workers wow. lost their lives in preventable factory fires. So it's just incredible because the solution is not complicated. It's fire exits. It's shutting down factories when they're unsafe. And the race to the bottom is so intense that brands are not being held accountable to making sure that the factories are paid a fair price to ensure safe working conditions.
Well, and also, I mean, when you're talking about a massive company like Nike, and it's easy to mention Nike just because in February, their net revenue was $8.4 billion with a B. there have been campaigns against this company for as long as I can remember. And if you're saying that it's able, that companies are able, like Alta Gracia, to pay workers a living wage, and it would only add a dollar to a sweatshirt, and this factory eats that cost, because these companies will say, well, then the cost will go up for the consumer, right? I mean, what's interesting is that a company like Nike is still charging $100 for clothing and shoes. But then you have the fast fashion like H&M, where you can get a shirt for $8. Can you talk just briefly about the differences between those two models?
Absolutely. I think what's interesting is people often put the blame on our desire to buy cheap clothes. But the honest truth is that the very expensive clothes also are paying very little to the employees who produce them. So the cost of the good really has nothing to do with how much the people who are making them are being paid. And the industry model has both 50% markup at the wholesaler level, 50% markup at the retailer. So 75% of that cost is just wholesaler and retailer markup. So if you're looking at a $35 sweatshirt, that's about $25. So absorbing that 90 cents of the living wage is not that difficult at the brand and the retailer level. It's impossible at the factory level because they're not getting paid enough. So we need to really go where the money is. And also, consumers are willing to pay the difference. Even if brands are not willing to pay the difference, research has shown that consumers are willing to. And the other thing is that the Alta Gracia model also is a different kind of business model. They have significantly lower turnover than a normal factory that loses 50 to 60% of its workers in an average year. Alta Gracia loses 5%. It takes an average worker 3 months to be trained, so they're saving money on retaining better workers who are better trained. They have less costly mistakes. They have higher quality standards. And so it's not just a moral argument. There is a business argument for paying a living wage and doing things differently.
Can we end with another story of a worker at Alta Gracia?
Absolutely. So these are my favorite. I like to tell the story of Clari because it demonstrates not just the transformational impact on one worker, but the transformational impact on the community. So Clari worked at the free trade zone at a standard factory and just found the conditions far too abusive. There was physical abuse, and workers never knew when they could leave. So they would literally lock workers in. And if you have kids at home, you wouldn't know if you'd be able to get home.
And this is common, right? Where
common.
Workers cannot leave.
Absolutely. And Yenny, who you mentioned, actually, one night as a single mom had it and climbed the fence to try and get out and got literally yanked back down and sent back to work until, late into the night. So for Clari, she just wasn't willing to make that sacrifice. And so her family barely survived on one person and her husband's income because it just wasn't worth it to her to face that kind of abuse. Now at Alta Gracia, she has enough discretionary income that she was able to start a business. So she has a local laundry and she was able to hire. Her husband works there and three other workers work there. So not only is a living wage allowing her family to have more economic stability and a living wage and decent working conditions, but now there's four more jobs in a community that really needs jobs. And so I think the living wage is not just about workers. It's not just about their families, but it's about the larger community. And again, this is just 90 cents more. This is really reasonable to ask, and it's transforming workers' lives, and we should be demanding it of the brands that produce our clothes.
What is next, just quickly, for this movement to try to force other multinationals to do the right thing?
So I think that continuing the activism on college campuses is really important and has been incredible in terms of moving the dial in the apparel industry. I think public procurement is a new area where that leverage has not been fully explored and should, and we should be looking to ensure our tax dollars go to goods that were made under decent conditions. And I think there's lots of opportunities for consumers to take collective action and get more involved.
Sarah Adler-Milstein is co-author with John Klein of Sewing Hope, How One Factory Challenges the Apparel Industry's Sweatshops. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. Sarah, thank you for all the work that you're doing, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us. It's Your Call.